Africa's cities are growing at an unprecedented rate. So understandably, African mayors have a long shopping list at the moment. They need to build roads, drainage, water, power connections, housing, public transport, waste systems, and the other basic public services that make dense urban life actually livable. Throughout this series on cities, we're going to be touching on all of these different areas that require investment. But there is an important paradox here. Despite the pressure on mayors to deliver on all of these priorities, in many places, they don't actually control the big fiscal levers. City revenues are low, transfers from the central government can be unpredictable, and city borrowing is either legally restricted or wildly expensive. Yet we also know that this is not an impossible task. Other countries have been able to build the institutions that allowed subnational governments to access long-term finance, raise revenues, and invest at scale. Welcome to Ideas in Development, a Vox Dev podcast on economic policy and research. I'm Oliver Hanney, the managing editor here at Vox Dev.
And I'm Curtis Lockhart, founder and executive director of the Africa Urban Lab. Today we're asking, how can mayors of fast-growing low-income cities possibly pay for all of the urban investments that are needed? Our guest today is Astrid Haas, who's worked on evidence-based policy reform to support fast-growing cities to finance growth. I'm biased, so rather than go through Astrid's entire impressive long list of titles, I'll just highlight that she is a fellow and lecturer here at the Africa Urban Lab. Astrid, welcome to Ideas in Development.
Thank you so much, Oliver, and thank you to you and Curtis for the invitation.
To start, can you explain where cities generally sit within the state in Africa? When we say a city government in the African context, what are we actually talking about? How much real power do cities tend to have?
It's a very interesting question. And actually, recently when I was teaching, a student asked me this. He said, what is a city, right? And I think, you know, cities generally are legally recognized entities in some way, shape, or form across most African countries. So like as a local government, as a subnational government, be it in the constitution or other some sort of other legal document. But I think there's a difference in what exists on paper and what happens in practice. And I think what happens in practice is that you find this entity called, this institutional entity called the city that has a lot of responsibility to deliver on infrastructure and services, but has actually not got a lot of powers, as you mentioned in your opening, to raise the money to do so. So it's a sort of decentralized entity in a fiscally centralized system. So I think that's the first thing. And I think the second thing to note is that what we call the administrative entity in many cases does not correspond to the geographical footprint of the city anymore. And I think we'll see this now becoming more and more the case as African cities are sprawling. And so where the administrative authority lies does not actually correspond to where the infrastructure and services need to go.
And how then should we think about the job of a mayor? Are they, you know, CEOs of a city or more like delivery managers for a budget that they actually don't control?
How should we think of the job as a mayor of an African city? I would say very difficult. I remember being on a panel a few years ago with a mayor of a large European city and a mayor of an African city. And the mayor of the African city said to the European city, imagine trying to manage a city of about 4 million people, which was the size of the city at the time, on a budget of own source revenues of $25 million. And you could see the mayor of the European city's mouth drop. So, you know, that is the extent of the challenge, right, is that you are responsible and you are locally accountable, but you don't have the money to do so. So I think, in effect, you know, we should be wanting to see more CEOs, but a CEO has an authority over their budget, which, you know, as you correctly alluded to, is not always the case. But what I will say is that I think, therefore, the role and where I've seen successful African city leadership is where they've been able to manage to expand the fiscal space rather than think of it about sort of just delivering on scarcity. And so these are also traits that a CEO has, like, for example, or what I think are good leadership traits in general, are traits of coalition building, of being able to meet with partners both at a national level, but also outside of the city level, being able to communicate, being able to build trust, being able to build those coalitions of your own constituencies to be able to understand what their needs are so that they can be accurately translated into something that can be funded or financed. And so I think that yes, on paper, it may look more like a delivery manager, but I think where the success lies is in true leadership, which is about how you manage this complexity within scarcity, but do not take scarcity as the end point, but rather as the starting point to expand your possibilities.
And you've alluded to this slightly already. How important is it then for a mayor to be able to raise revenue locally, and what changes when they're able to do so?
I mean, it's absolutely critical, right? And I think, you know, where I always come down on this is that it's just a fundamental part of the social contract. You know, if you're responsible for delivering and you're responsible for raising money, those two things go in hand in hand. And so if the money is being raised elsewhere and you're supposed to deliver, or alternatively, you're raising the money but not are responsible for delivery, it's impossible to see how you can build that fiscal social contract, which is really what underpins what the virtuous cycle of revenue raising is. But, you know, from a more technical point of view, is that being able to raise revenues is really the signal then to be able to also raise more money, right? So if you have a steady stream of your own source revenues, then you show that that stream coming in can be used and leveraged to be to raise other finance from which you then can repay that. And so I think that that in and of itself is an important reason. But I think the second important reason is that if you are working at a local level, you are closer to what the needs are of the people. So going back to my social contract point is that you also know what you need to be raising the revenues for. So raising money does not exist in a vacuum. You raise money for something. And being able to make that link also helps you raise the money itself. However, I do want to make a point because I think it's often under stress. A city will always, by necessity, well, actually, in most cases, there are some exceptions, will have a smaller tax base than a national level. So there will need to be some money that comes, some money that is reallocated from national to local government. So a city cannot, in most cases, survive just on what it earns itself. And so I think it's not necessarily about just own source revenue. It's about striking the right balance between the different sources of revenue. That is really important.
And given the obvious benefits, it seems odd that many cities don't seem to be borrowing. What are the main barriers that block, say, a city in Africa being able to borrow money?
It's a good question, and it's one that I'm asked quite a lot. And I think I will just rephrase it a little bit to say it's not always a good idea to borrow, right? It's a good idea to borrow in certain situations. One is if you have the fiscal capacity to borrow. So what do I mean by that? Alluding to the own source revenue question we just discussed, or the transfer question, you have enough money to pay back that borrowing. And that being able to pay that back is not going to compromise you actually delivering on your other services and infrastructure that you need, right? So you really need to have the fiscal capacity to borrow as a city. The second thing is that you really need to borrow only for certain types of projects. Not all projects are suitable for borrowing. And this is a point that I encounter a lot in my work with cities, is that there is this sometimes this misguided notion that everything can be packaged into what's called a bankable project. So everything can be packaged for which you can go find finance and borrow for it. That's not always the case. You know, there are public goods, and public goods are public goods for a reason, right? It's not necessarily that they will generate revenue or generate a profit, but they have a really important societal function to do. So I just wanted to sort of caveat the question that, you know, borrowing is not necessarily always good. However, it is good for those cities who can do it and should be doing it, and for those infrastructures that are productive and can generate economic returns. And for those, there is a lot less borrowing happening. And part of the reason is that cities themselves need to get their own house in order, so their own financials are just not very attractive to investors. So, you know, financial transparency, their revenue streams, their audits, you know, that's what a city can cover. But then there's also other challenges, such as national legislation that is overly restrictive. There's political hurdles where some national governments do not like cities to borrow or become financially independent, particularly in where cities are opposition strongholds, which is often the case, but in less opposition-friendly countries. And then there's also the third reason, which is, you know, there's not enough local currency for cities to borrow. So cities shouldn't necessarily be borrowing or shouldn't be borrowing in international and hard currency, because unlike a national government, they cannot hedge against the foreign currency risk. And this can create further problems down the line.
So we've touched on the demand side of this question. On the supply side, there are not exactly a huge number of options for MERPs, right? Why is the supply of long-term finance so scarce for African cities?
Well, I think the first point is that often financial markets are just very shallow in many of these cases. And as I mentioned, cities do need to borrow in local currency. Most of their revenue is generated in local currency, so they want to be able to borrow so they can repay in local currency. And there's not necessarily always a lot of local currency financing to go around. And where there is, for example, pension and social security schemes, that money is not necessarily being reinvested in the country. It's sometimes being, or not at a local level anyway, maybe being reinvested in the country. And so I think there needs to be sort of a shift in thinking about how you link the reforms of financial markets to the needs at a local level. But the second thing is, and this is where something I have seen work quite well across the continent as well, is to have what we call financial intermediaries, right? So these are institutions that can exist and can take on, let's say, loans in US dollars or in euros or in other international forex and intermediate that into local currency loans or in some cases grants for cities. And these financial intermediaries exist in various shapes and forms. So there's not sort of one type of intermediary, but they can take the form of like a national development bank, or in some Francophone African countries, they are in the form of national savings corporations. But they work really well because they provide the local currency and also they have an understanding of the domestic market. The question is how you strengthen these types of institutions as really big, important players to help finance the needs of cities.
And just on sources of capital, you've written about the lack of domestic capital markets across African countries that are investing in subnationals and serving as financial intermediaries. There's a successful model in France that you've written about, and I'm going to butcher the name, the Caisse de Dépôt Consignation, the CDC model. Could you talk us through that model?
Yeah, this is a model that was developed in France, and as a result, it exists, as I said, in many sort of more Francophone African-speaking countries. But this is essentially a model where there is an institution linked to the national treasury, which accumulates the government's domestic savings and is able to on-lend these locally. And so you find these, for example, in a lot of North African countries like Tunisia has a Caisse de Dépôt and others. Then there's other models, for example, like the FEC in Morocco, which is very much like, again, associated with the national treasury, but does lending specifically only to local governments across the country. And then you have totally different models from the Francophone countries. And I guess the most successful model that we have on the continent is actually a regional development bank, which is the Development Bank of Southern Africa. And they do regional lending, but they also work on municipal lending. And they have, I think, one of the biggest municipal portfolios, definitely in Africa, but across developing countries as well. So again, it depends on what your institutional structure is. Like a Caisse de Dépôt would be very difficult, for example, to set up in Uganda. But the principles of like how you you be able to accumulate or you aggregate your savings, your domestic savings in one place and unlend that. That principle, I think, should form the basis of how many of these institutions should think about lending to cities in the future.
So just to summarize your thinking on this area, do you think that the core problem then is not that there is no money, but that there is not a system that can safely and effectively channel money to cities?
So I think there's a lot of money in the world and it's flowing around. I think the challenge in my sense is it's not, first of all, it's not the right type of money. In terms of, you know, we also want to be able to increase domestic savings. I mentioned to you earlier, like I'm living in Hong Kong, and actually mainland China was one of the places that actually managed to fund a lot of its infrastructure through its own sort of domestic savings rate. And partly the domestic savings rate, unfortunately, in Africa is relatively low is because we've urbanized without industrializing, which I'm sure you have discussed on your podcast before. And there's a lot of economics literature around that, but there's just a very low domestic savings rate. That's the type of money that's needed for these sort of public infrastructure and services. In terms of when we talk about private capital, again, there's a lot of private capital to go around. Also within Africa, there's a lot of private capital. But channeling that to projects means that the projects themselves need to be very well defined. They need to be very well prepared. And so there's also a dearth of well-prepared projects. There's a lot of ideas and there's a lot of need, but translating those ideas and need into something that is then investable is also a space. So it's a bit of a supply and demand mismatch, but also it's what type of supply and what type of demand there is. So I think there's two things. So one is that like in many other places, states and cities in Mexico, I think this was around the 2000s, were very dependent on transfers. I think in some places up to 95% of their budgets were made up of transfers. This is not an uncommon picture as well for many African cities, particularly for smaller cities. They tend to be more reliant on transfers. And when we think about creditworthiness, we tend to think about increasing own source revenue. But in some cases, your tax bases are just too small that you would be able to do that in a way that would be able to get you that creditworthiness. So you want to be able to also look at the other sources of revenue that you have, or in this case, transfers, and how you are able to stabilize those. And so I think the Mexican reforms show us two things. I think one is that the first part of the reform was how you make these transfers predictable and timely, because this is a very big challenge with intergovernmental transfers in many of the cities that I work in, is that they don't know when they're going to come or how much is going to come. And you cannot plan or be able to budget or leverage that. Once they'd stabilized the transfers, then they created a mechanism to be able to ring fence the transfers such that the states in this case could borrow against them. So like, you know that your transfer is always going to come in and it's going to come in on time and you know how much you're going to get. You can borrow against that. And investors knew that the first part of the transfer, so before it came to the state, would be used to repay them. And so they had a guarantee that they were actually going to get repaid from a source of revenue that was stable and predictable. So I think it just helped increase the confidence, both for the local governments themselves in terms of the transfer they get, and from the investor side too. And therefore unlock another source of finance for infrastructure.
And does any of that experience stand out as kind of specifically or particularly useful to think about for African cities today?
I mean, absolutely. I think especially given transfers still play a very big role in city budget. And actually, I recently heard that Nigeria is also looking at a similar, or maybe have already implemented a similar type of reform. And I think generally for cities, irrespective of leveraging the transfers, I think for cities, given how much transfers are and will continue to remain an important source of funds for them, being able to ensure their predictability and their both in terms of the amount and in terms of the time is critical if we're going to be able to plan. But then also thinking about how we do reforms and transfers to improve creditworthiness is important.
You've also written about reform in the Philippines. What were the successful institutional ingredients there?
So what I like about the Filipino reform model was that they differentiated between the types of cities. So as I mentioned before, when you were asking me about cities borrowing, I don't think every city should or can be borrowing, right? You don't want cities that are not ready to borrow because that can create more risks, far more risks, not only for the city, but overall, than benefits. And so I think in the Philippines in 1996, when they put together their local government framework, they differentiated between types of cities. So they said, okay, you know, larger cities who are maybe more fiscally sound and had a creditworthy profile, they would be able to go out to market to borrow. Medium-sized cities or those with, you know, close to creditworthy but still sort of struggling but could do some borrowing can borrow from sort of local institutions, the financial intermediaries we discussed, national financial intermediaries. And then those smaller cities who are not creditworthy but also needed financing for their infrastructure, they would then be prioritized for for national transfers and national subsidies for that. And that model, what it does is that it releases the public budget to support those cities that need it most, rather than keeping those cities also still dependent on the national budget who may be able to get financing from elsewhere. And it's a model that has worked successfully elsewhere, so most notably in Colombia in Latin America. But alongside the reforms to the legal system, they also created institutional structures around the same time. The one was a municipal fund development office, which was there to help provide finance for local infrastructure projects. And the other one was a local guarantee unit, which was to crowd in private finance by providing government guarantees. And then depending on the size of the loan and the riskiness of the borrower or the profile of the city who is borrowing, the borrower would pay to this local government guarantee unit. The other thing the guarantee unit did, which I thought was very, very interesting, or does, is do local credit ratings. So it assesses cities against each other rather than sort of against the international standards. So this was a sort of much more wholesale reform, but also about sort of meeting cities where they are in terms of their capacity, but also ensuring that the public budget is being able to be used in its most efficient manner across the different needs and across the different urban system.
And we don't just need to look outside Africa. Freetown in Sierra Leone is a great example of a mayor who needed money to implement her reform agenda and then made property tax actually work to raise that money, to raise own source revenue in the city of Freetown. Could you talk us through the Freetown case and how Mayor Aki Sawyer achieved this?
Yeah, so Mayor Yvonne Aki Sawyer, who's currently still the mayor today, she's in her second term. I think she's done one of the most notable property tax reforms, not only in Africa, but globally. When she came into the city, it was a city that was suffering from high urbanization rates, low infrastructure and investments, poor service delivery. And so it was clear that they needed to reform. They needed, but reform requires money. And it's a bit of a chicken and egg issue, right? In terms of you need money to be able to reform, but if your social contract is so broken that people don't believe you're going to reform, they're not going to pay their taxes to be able to do that. And so Mayor Yvonne Aki Sawyer faced a sort of dual stranded challenge, which is she had to rebuild the fiscal contract to be able to raise money, to be able to make keep the promises that she made. And do this within, at the time, her first mayoral term. And so what she did, which I think is a really important lesson, she started actually with the basis of what do we actually want to use this money for? Often at time, revenue reforms are done with like, we need to raise more money. But that's not the point. People are not going to pay you more money or pay their taxes if they don't trust you. So she created trust. She created what she called the Transform Freetown agenda, where she had a lot of buy-in from her local constituency, which is the residents of Freetown who inputted into this plan. And then she said, okay, great, now we have a plan, but we need to raise money for this plan, right? This plan can't just come into existence like that. And that's where she got the buy-in for this property tax reform, right? And I'm in no way, shape or form saying it was easy, and there's been a lot of case studies written on this, but she was one of that, to my point about leadership, okay, she was the mayor of the city. But beyond being the mayor of the city, she showed this incredible capacity to build coalitions across all these different constituents to get them to pay the tax that everywhere else is called the tax that people love to hate, right? Because it's such a visible tax. And even then, when the national government tried to thwart the reform because, for political reasons, she was even able to overcome that. And even when she then started her tax reform during the time of COVID, where most other cities in the world were reducing or waiving taxes because of the COVID pandemic, she still pushed through with her tax reform. I think it's probably one of the only cities that did a tax reform during a pandemic. And this is because she really had created the momentum and the buy-in behind her agenda. So I think, there's the technical side of it. You know, they reformed the data, they collected the data, they reformed the systems, they created fit-for-purpose digital systems, they retrained enumerators, they updated their property cadastre. So that's the technical side. But I think, and that technical side can be replicated and is being replicated elsewhere. But I think the true, the pinnacle of this reform was her leadership and her ability to really rebuild the fiscal contract around her Transform Freetown agenda.
I guess that lesson is quite a hard one to transfer, right? Because it's hard to find leaders who are able to mobilize support, build coalitions and policies like this and see them through. Is there anything that you think other African cities can actually take from the Freetown case and apply to their own settings?
I think what Freetown has proved is that it can be done, right? We have the most successful property tax reform in the world being done in an African city. And I think that in and of itself is a lesson to be learned, right? We don't need to, as African cities, import models or import expertise or import know-how from elsewhere. What we need to do is be able to make it fit for purpose for our context. I think that's the first thing. And I think the second thing is a real notion that people are actually willing to pay tax if they know what they're going to get from their tax, right? I think there's sometimes this misguided notion that everyone just wants to avoid paying tax. But that's in a situation where your social contract is really weak or even broken. You really need to respect that this is people's hard-earned money from their living, you know, and they want to know that it is going to be effectively implemented into a plan that they buy into. And so that's why I think linking not only revenue reform, revenue for the sake of raising revenue, it's incredibly critical to link it to expenditure reform as well, right? The two things go hand in hand. And we tend to focus more on the revenue rather than how the money is being spent, but how the money is being spent will be the thing that entices people to pay the money. And then I think the final piece that I want to say is that I think sometimes, I think what's the saying, perfection is the enemy of the good. But the point is that you don't need a perfect system. You don't need to be doing the best practice system and then be hindered because all the pieces are not working. No, you need to be able to do reforms that build credible momentum over time and then build on that momentum to then further reform, right? And I think this is what Mayor Aki Sawyer has done so incredibly well. And actually, currently, they're in the process of raising finance for the first cable car for the city, right? So these are reforms that then build on each other, that then give you credibility, that then create credibility vis-a-vis external investors, et cetera, and show that. So I think that start and create that momentum and then be able to build on that.
One example people might have been expecting us to talk about is China, which is often held up as kind of the gold standard of a rapid urbanization story. Are there any lessons on city finance that Africa should look to follow, and any that actually it should seek to avoid from China's experience?
So now living in China, I think it's like super fascinating to see this happen on the ground. I mean, it is absolutely incredible the speed at which infrastructure is built here and the scale to which infrastructure is built here. And I think there are definitely certain pieces that I think are worth taking, but there may be they may not be the standards that people think. So I think when people think of China, they think of a very centralized government, which is true. But actually, in its urbanization story, a big factor in its success was that it allowed its local governments to experiment. and to find out what worked best for them and experiment within parameters. So the central government set out certain parameters and provided incentives to local government bureaucrats to meet certain targets. But then how they met those targets was done differently in every city in China. And when you think about the vast, how big the country is, it's a very diverse country, even though it's one country. And so this experimentation was key. The second is that it managed to very much use its land, and land is most cities' biggest asset, and to leverage the land and land-based financing tools to finance the infrastructure investments that it made. And it managed to deliver this infrastructure before people settled, right? And so in some ways, you know, that's important because once people have settled, there is not only the financial cost of retrofitting, but there's the social and political cost of moving people to be able to retrofit infrastructure there. So I think that's really important. However, with a word of caution, because we now have the benefit of hindsight, and in many places in China, the land was over-leveraged, right? And maybe they over-relied on land sales. And land is actually a finite product, right? That's why, you know, its value increases when demand increases. That became problematic because then once the sort of land was leased, there was not very many other ways to get revenue. And for example, China doesn't have a property tax yet, right? And so they're only sort of retroactively thinking about doing that. But the worst time to bring in a property tax is when your property values are already high, because then the tax is going to be high as well. So sometimes it's easier to do reforms when you are at the beginning. And so, you know, for those leaders or those African city leaders who worry about, you know, bringing in a property tax when, let's say, the population is very poor, there's ways that you can address this through the property tax, but avoiding the tax, bringing in the tax altogether, is problematic because it will be more and more difficult as and when property and land values go higher. And I think the second thing we see in China is that it over-leveraged the climate, right? We don't have that luxury. We live in a climate-constrained environment. And so Africa is going to have to find a new growth path.
So returning to our opening question, which was how can cities pay for stuff, what should national governments and city governments prioritize today in order to raise revenue and unlock finance?
So I think the first thing they should prioritize is that they really need to start working together better. That sounds simple, but unfortunately, it's not always done. National governments and city governments are not always sort of singing off the same hymn sheet, so to speak. But urbanization is actually a national growth or a national development strategy. As many of your listeners of this podcast as economists will know, you know, there's not many things economists will agree on, but maybe one thing they will do is that, you know, across history and across globe up until now, sort of urbanization has been associated with industrialization and growth and development. It's currently not the case in the context of Africa, and a lot has been written about that. But in part, it's because it's not just any urbanization, it's well-managed urbanization. And for well-managed urbanization, national and local governments need to work together. And then think from a national government perspective, you know, I mentioned how intergovernmental fiscal transfers are just so important to many cities, but particularly to the smaller cities who are fastest urbanizing and have the least ability to raise own source revenue at the moment. And therefore, ensuring that those transfers are predictable, that they are timely, and that they can be used to plan and, you know, in the future maybe also used to borrow against, I think would be very, very important. And then secondly, about creating differentiated frameworks, not treating every city in the same way, and allowing those cities that can borrow to borrow, obviously within the right regulatory scope, and ensuring that this is done prudently, but that also frees up space to support those other cities that cannot. And then I think finally, from a national government's perspective, is either to develop where they don't exist or to strengthen where they do, these financial intermediaries who can work on channeling finance to cities. Cities themselves have a lot of work to do. And this is very much about, as I said before, getting their own house in order, because they really do need to have the creditworthiness and the backing to be able to show that they are not only, you know, raising money and spending for their own constituents, but there's that they're open for business and are able to handle other money well. And this requires investing in, you know, not only the financial capacity, but sort of administrative capacity overall. And I think then, you know, I am a feminist urban economist. So I also want to just end on emphasizing it's not just about financing cities faster or financing cities more. It's also about financing cities fairly and ensuring that the cities work for the majority, not just the privileged few. And this means ensuring that as much as you're focusing on raising your funding and finance, also focus on your expenditure, because that's what the fiscal contract is built on.
This has been Ideas in Development. The best way to make sure you don't miss an episode is to subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. And our past episodes, as ever, are available at voxdev.org.